Each week, we try to go inside Chicago's fast-growing tech community to see what the next big thing might be. This week, we're featuring Emerson Spartz, who built the number one Harry Potter news site, MuggleNet, at the age of 12, then went on to launch more than 30 websites, including OMG Facts and Give Me Hope. I'm Scott Catoon, and let's start talking about tomorrow's business today. Emerson, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, there's so many different things, as I mentioned offline, that I want to talk to you about this. The first thing I guess I'll say is congrats on the a major Series B that you guys closed with Tribune and Ronin. Those are some awesome people.
Thank you.
When was that, December, or is that before?
December.
That? December. That's fantastic. I guess, well, the first thing with regard to that is, so how are you guys going to be working with the Tribune? What was the, what on your end, what was the thing that you thought would be a good partnership with them?
Tribune is the kind of media company that is strong where we're weak, and we're weak where they're strong. We've built one of the fastest growing media companies in the world, but most of our expertise comes in the form of digital. It's testing, it's iterating, and it's ultimately distribution through social channels like Facebook and Twitter. And Tribune, with having enormous assets that aren't are not quite as digital. Yeah. There's just so many opportunities for us to work together in sales and cross promotion and knowledge sharing, and it was just we realized as we were talking that it was a perfect fit.
Yeah, I can't agree more. I mean, like I said, we were talking about this before the show. You know, the concept behind the podcast we're doing right now is sort of to bring that digital tech startup scene in Chicago into a place where really most of the stuff that they do at the Tribune covers kind of the old man news, and it's nice to be able to get a different take on things and broaden their audience to make it more available, more consumable for our generation. You're what, 28?
I turned 29 yesterday, actually.
Oh, happy belated birthday. I'm 31, so we're kind of in that same kind of age group, and it's just been difficult for me to read traditional news over the last few years. I just get bored too quickly. I think it's definitely, I'm looking forward to see what Dose.com and Dose in general can do to help elevate the Tribune's offering. One of the other things, as I mentioned, is education. So you have probably the most non-traditional education of anyone that has come on here. I mean, obviously you went to Notre Dame, which I went to Marquette for undergrad, Northwestern for grad school. So all of my Notre Dame friends, we used to have kind of a little rivalry in sports because basketball, Marquette would play Notre Dame. So we'll leave that alone. But tell me a little bit about your educational background.
My educational, so I'm a middle school dropout.
Awesome. It's legendary.
So when I was 12, I convinced my parents to let me drop out of school and start homeschooling myself. And about a month later, created a website called MuggleNet. MuggleNet was like the eighth of a bunch of I just started creating a bunch of websites, and I was really into Harry Potter.
And this isn't so you give context to things. This isn't now where there's like Squarespace and like all these things you can just like Wix, like you can just create a site. This was kind of like when that's what you're 12, so what does that put you, like 99, 98,
yep,
something like that. So like in 99 and 8, the internet wasn't exactly like the most easy to understand thing, particularly for a kid.
No, there was not the plethora of tools and services available that there are now.
Yeah.
And MuggleNet became my full-time job for the next decade. Still own MuggleNet. It still is the number one Harry Potter website. But that was my 10 hours a day project. MuggleNet eventually grew to have, it was about 50 million monthly page views. We had one of the biggest forums online, one of the biggest fan fiction sites, one of the biggest RPGs. We published a number of books, one of which became a New York Times bestseller. And so I just got to learn a ton through that experience. I learned a little bit of everything. I learned how to code, how to write, how to edit, how to lead, how to manage, how to design. And then eventually I decided to go to college for fun, which was a very bad reason to go to college, and I got bored very quickly.
That's the same reason I went to college. It's really not that bad a reason to go to college. Depends on what you like for fun, though. That's the thing.
Right, yeah. So I was going to drop out and start another business, but I wanted to go really big with the next one.
Yeah.
I wanted to identify a model that would maximize my probability of getting to a billion by the time I was 30. Now, I knew that the odds of that happening were infinitesimally small,
yeah,
but I figure, statistically speaking, I'll probably get 3-ish swings at this by my 30th birthday, so how do I maximize the probability of one of those swings connecting?
So, I love this.
I set off on this quest to I want to be able to connect dots and see patterns between different disciplines and industries. So I set a goal of reading one nonfiction book every day until graduation. So business, politics, psychology, economics, technology, science. But it wasn't just reading. It wasn't just books. It was going through 10Ks, research, abstracts. It was studying thousands of different companies and industries, just looking for patterns. But it was actually a three-part process. So there was reading, reviewing, and rehearsing. Reading was just part of it. The second part of it was reviewing. So I actually spent the first 6 6 months doing a deep dive into the neuroscience of learning and memory, because I concluded that learning how to learn was literally the most important skill you could ever learn, because it's the root of everything else you learn. So you learn how to learn more effectively, and it has a snowball effect on everything else you do after the fact. It's
and they
like
don't
getting
teach
an expense return.
In any, I mean, any,
it's crazy. Which is, it's crazy okay, they don't so teach this.
This is the part that I was talking about before. So this blew my mind. Like, as a student, I believe that I'm a semi-intelligent person. I have gone and accomplished good things, you know, scholastically speaking, but throughout my entire, I'm not even lying to you, from kindergarten through really college, undergrad, I was probably a C student the whole way through. And it was not because I didn't understand the material. I didn't understand why we were doing this material. I would find all kinds of things like, this is such a waste of time. And I would leave and go do something like read something else, or I'd pick out some, you know, I'd be drawing things. I never understood, and I was unable. My mom was a teacher. I was unable to convince her, obviously, what you were, which is that you were able to drop out of middle school. I would have done that in a flash. I don't know if I would have made as much use of it as you did, but either way, this is the most fascinating thing, because I've never in my life yet met somebody who said it exactly like you did. They don't teach you how to learn in school, which is baffling. Continue, sorry.
Certainly a passion area of mine. So through that, I concluded that one of the highest ROI things you could possibly do with your time was to review what you already read. Like, you know, if you spend, for every 9 minutes you spend reading, if you spend 1 minute reviewing, you'll get as much value out of that 1 minute reviewing as you get out of the 9 minutes of reading, which is like the craziest high ROI thing you could possibly do. And so that was game changing for me intellectually. And so I ended up building out different spaced repetition schedules where I would review everything that I wanted to remember on a schedule of a day later, a week later, a month later, and then every 6 months in perpetuity. And then the third part of the process was rehearsal or practice. Like, how do you actually practice applying all these, you know, intellectual concepts? It's not as simple as just going to the gym and shooting 1,000 jumpers, or going to the golf driving range and hitting 1,000 golf balls. So I organized all the information into frameworks to contextualize it. So I'd have a persuasion framework, a negotiation framework, an innovation framework, et cetera. So, for example, the way I'd practice innovation is I'd go to Walmart and I'd go from product to product to product on the shelves and take every product and practice applying every different type of business model to that product to practice generating ideas for new products. And so I quickly came up with thousands of, you know, billion-dollar ideas. and I realized that, like, well, you know, it's not really about the idea as much as it's about the thousand ideas that you have to actually get to the finish line of a successful business. So I started to get really obsessed with this notion of probability of success and how to measure and quantify probability of success, which led to eventually applying that notion to the current business. It was a combination of viral potential, which I've been obsessed with understanding why things go viral for a long time, as well as the notion of probability of success that led to our big breakthrough.
That's fascinating. So I guess, I mean, I honestly could sit here and talk to you the entire day about this, the educational platform, but I imagine you still use it today pretty much the same thing. I mean, there's so many different things you get to learn as it comes out. You've got to be, I always look at it like having, I have a pretty good memory, so I'm able to recall things sort of photographically. I can read a quote, or I can read something and see it and just pull it all the time. Kind of because I, like you were talking about the review, I didn't have it as systematic as you did. I would read something, and then afterward, the key parts I would try to, like, that were in my mind important, I'd write them down. So, like, basically I would have a book, and then I would have a journal, and I would sit there all day long. And I did this in graduate school where, like I said, very different reasons. I was going out and maybe doing some other things that I shouldn't have been doing. But either way, I didn't have enough time to learn what I was supposed to do for a test. So I would literally just read the book, and I'd write down the five or six things that I thought were going to be obviously important, and then I never forgot them. And then anytime I want to go back and refresh, now I don't have to go back and read the book. I just grab my Cliff Notes, if you will, and I'm ready to go. Going forward, I imagine every time you learn something new or you have some new practice, you're able to kind of notate what it is and what you noticed that was different, the trend, why you saw it this way, and then go back and review it and in perpetuity, as you said, so that you essentially never – you retain everything that you've ever learned. Is that –
I retain everything that I consider worth retaining.
Well, yeah, of course.
Yeah, so that it's very much an 80-20 thing. Like, I focus on the 20% of things I think are worth remembering, and I kind of mentally discard the rest. But I've got a variety of different systems designed to capture and retain different types of information in different contexts.
Simply amazing. This is like talking to the Khan Academy here.
This is my favorite. Like, there's nothing that I get more excited talking about than this topic.
I know. We've got a couple shows we talked about. Khan Academy is one of them. We shredded some of the educational institutions around here that are considered quite good. We've just shredded them, but it's fine. They don't call me for speeches or anything. So it's, until then they're just going to be shredded. Another thing that I'd like to talk about is, so essentially, I mean, a Business Insider wrote this article about you referring to at 12 years old, you built a website that you have essentially just turned into a media empire. Obviously, there's a lot more work that goes into it, and it's not just one website, and there's a lot of generalization around that. But how did you... I know you said that you're really into virality and sort of figuring out why things go that way. Patterns, these are all things that lend themselves to developing a fantastic web platform. How did you know when you were I'd say maybe you're 15, right? And the blog is just, or the website is just starting to blow up and you're making a bunch of money. How did you know there was absolutely media and it wasn't something else that you wanted to spend all of your time and your, I guess, effort on?
I never knew that it was media. I knew that I loved how ideas spread and evolve. That was always fascinating to me. The notion of evolution, especially when applied to ideas, was just the most fascinating topic. So, it, you know, virality was not even a word that I knew existed until way after the fact.
Sure.
But I knew that I was always interested in, like, why do people enjoy this content versus this other content? And I enjoyed the game of trying to figure out how to create better content that people would engage more with and would find more meaning in. And that just kind of morphed and evolved over time into the current business, which is just like a much larger scale enterprise that does what I was doing in a more, you know, a smaller scale earlier on.
So why don't you get into that? What exactly is, I mean, obviously it went to Sports Media, which then became Dose Media, and that it is, houses a bunch of things from OMG Facts to Give Me Hope, Dose.com. Why don't you get into a little bit about what Dose Media is, what the focus is, and some of the major websites that you guys currently have in your portfolio?
At Dose, our focus is on telling what we call stories worth sharing. So we believe that you can quantify quality in the form of engagement metrics. I mean, it's very hard. I mean, there's subjective quality, which is tough, and then there's
totally
objective
agree.
Quality. So for us, we've built predictive technology that detects stories worth sharing. Our editors choose the best stories after our algorithms have scored them for probability of success, and then our technology shares them with the right audience wherever they are across the web. So unlike other media companies, which are usually just comprised of mainly, you know, writers and salespeople, our company is majority engineers and data scientists, because we believe that's the future of media is in that technology.
The journalism schools must love you.
Well, we like to think that the way that the technology works, the technology can take good writers and make them great writers.
You know what? I have to tell you. So in 2012, I was at Medill at Northwestern, and I tried to use that exact same line, and you know what? It did not fly at all. I tried. We had multiple innovation projects. We worked on the relaunch of craftrecipes.com. We worked on a company called Big Frame, which was acquired by YouTube, Google. We worked on a ton of stuff, the Laud, the Sun-Times, Rapports, all these projects. And I was always the odd person out. I mean, every time. Sitting there going, aggregation, aggregation, aggregation. We got to find, like, it's not, you can't, the human I cannot choose because you're biased and you cannot separate that bias. You need some sort of assistant or some sort of algorithm that determines multiple factors as to what is going to bring this to the top. Is it consumable digitally? Is it shareable? Is it entertaining? Is the title going to have something that has enough keywords that's going to pop it up? There's all these things, and all of the journalism students did not find me funny at all. And so when I first started, I had heard about you a couple of years ago, actually. And I first started kind of following what you were doing. It was just like, I don't know how many times I brought you up in class. So you were a 25-year-old kid being brought up in our classes. And I was like, you guys, this dude is going to take this whole Chicago world over, I'm telling you. So now I think you're getting closer. I don't know if you got the billion yet, but you're getting closer. So I totally understand that. One of the things, though, that they were critical of me, and I'm sure that you've heard criticism before as well, is sort of when you do aggregate, there's sort of the copyright and there's all these other things, and whether or not that's your content or where you're pulling the content from. How have you dealt with that? How do you feel about that? That people think things like that?
Things like what?
Well, I mean, like for me, like we had a couple websites that we would aggregate and pull stories that other people had written on our site because we thought it was an important thing. So like Sports Mockery, for example, I don't know if you follow Sports Mockery on Facebook, they will pull stories that come from all over the place and they pop up on their site and they get paid advertising because they've got all these different stories that they didn't write them. There's a criticism of the mainstream journalism people saying, well, wait a minute. You have to have your own staff that writes your own stories to make that you should have before you make a profit on it. There is some criticism that comes across for anyone who does aggregation. And I was just curious if that's something that you have ever dealt with or if people say to you like, hey, you know, you're benefiting from other people's writing is what I'm saying.
Sure. We find that the vast majority, like 99.999% of people whose work appears on Dose, are usually thrilled with the exposure. They are just so ecstatic that people love their work and that they're getting, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of people to feel to learn, laugh, or feel inspired by their work. And for the one in 10,000 who doesn't like it, that's fine. We take it down.
Sure.
So, I mean, this is one of those things where we believe fundamentally that there's a lot of wasted effort if you have 1,000 different writers all covering the same story, but telling it. I mean, it's redundant. It's just completely redundant. And that's why things like the AP exist, right? You don't need to have every single newsroom covering the same story in only the very most slightly different way when there's so many other stories that could be covered. And that's where curation and aggregation kind of come in to fill the gap.
I have to tell you, like, I'm totally on your side on this. I mean, I remember feeling this. I did not articulate it perhaps as well as you did, because you literally just kind of walked through it. What I would try to shorthand say to everybody was, like, obviously, like you said, who doesn't want to be shared on a site that has tons of eyes? This is the whole point, that you get to share what your creation is. I mean, that was the whole point of this. However, it speaks in my mind, at least, a lot to the editors who are in charge of some of these places, that you don't understand the sharing, the entire process of sharing, and people wanting to share stories on Facebook and on Twitter and wherever. If you don't want your story to be shared, I mean, I don't even really know where to start with you, because that's the entire purpose of putting information digitally.
Yeah, if you don't want people to share your story, it means you don't want people to see your story, which is generally against the goals of journalism. And to be fair, we're not journalists. We don't cover the news. Our content is more entertainment content, and we have teams of writers who focus on producing, you know, high quality original content in addition to you know, the curation and aggregation that we do on top of that. But you're right. It's an anachronistic way of looking at the world, where success is measured by almost everybody now in terms of how many people engaged with your content.
It is. And I mean, now that we've trashed education and we're about to rip on media a little bit. No, but seriously, one of the other part of this that's, I think, is fascinating is when you look at, I think one of the concerns they have is, like you just said, we're not journalists. I'm not covering news. I'm not covering news. I interview people like yourself that are doing amazing things. That's not breaking news. I'm just trying to find out more about you. There's a concern, I think, among journalists that the line is becoming thinner and thinner and thinner between what is gossip, entertainment, any story, and news, and whether or not a journalist should be covering a gossip or a story that's more purely entertainment. And I think ultimately, I think it's sort of it's a weird way to look at things. It's like you're up on a perch determining what I, the viewer, gets to read, when in reality, I, the viewer, should be telling, or listener, reader, should be telling you what I want to see. And that sort of is where I think the line, you know, dictates itself.
Yeah, it's interesting. It used to be possible to tell people what they should want to consume. It's just not possible anymore, because consumers have too many choices. So it doesn't matter what it should be. It matters what's possible.
Absolutely.
And that's, like, if I ever get into this argument, it's usually about, like, it doesn't matter if you think it should be that way. It isn't that way. If you don't provide value for your readers, they won't read your content.
Yep.
So if you have an important story to tell, let's say, think of, like, a really important story that could create change in the justice system or something like that, you need to find a way to tell that story in a way that people will want to read it. You can't just put it out there and assume that people will read it. It used to be that you could, because if you were the only game in town, like if you were, say, a newspaper and you were the only source of news that people had, then you could dictate what people read. Now you just can't.
It used to be that way. It's not anymore.
Right.
That's an amazing point.
And it's hard for some stories. Some stories don't package up as nicely as, you know, some stories. You know, it's hard to compete with cat videos and things like that. There's no question about that. And there's no question there's important stories that need to be told. And we collectively have to figure out how to make sure that those important stories are told effectively enough so that people want to consume them. That's the challenge.
It's a huge challenge. I tell people every day about this, whether it's businesses that work with startup companies or just people in general. We're trying to get user base. Is what is desirable, what is viable, and ultimately what is possible. If you try to fight any of the three things, you're fighting an uphill battle. It's just not worth the effort. And I think you've explained that very well. And I think it probably shows to why you've been so successful so far. You understand that at the end of the day, changing free will is not very possible. Is the way that it is. On our parting notes, the last thing I kind of wanted to bring up and say to you is, so give me hope. I just thought it was really fascinating, because I hated my job. Like, my previous job when I got out of college, I hated it. And I would go to F My Life every single day and read other people, just like, I know this sounds absolutely terrible, but I would read it for inspiration, because, like, dude, my life is not that bad. This guy's life is way worse than mine. So tell me kind of how that spun off into Give Me Hope real quick, and we'll wrap it up.
So my co-founder, who's also my wife, she also founded a popular website, and she was 12, so I totally hit the jackpot there.
So why didn't you start with this?
So we're both kind of pathological optimists. We believe that, I mean, even on Dose, almost all of our content is positive content.
Yeah.
And that also incidentally happens to be content people want to share.
Sure.
People want to project the right image of themselves into the world, and positive content tends to fit that bill more. And we saw an opportunity to create a website where people would share uplifting and inspiring true personal stories. And if we effectively filtered those stories to make sure that the best stories rose to the top, and that we, you know, had effective distribution, that a site like that could go viral. And it did, back in 2009. It ended up doing, you know, we got like 180,000 visitors on our first day. We ended up getting a book deal from it, and we ended up spinning out an entire network of sites similar to it, where people would share other kinds of uplifting love stories, people sharing their secrets. And then we moved into humor content. because we saw a lot of opportunities there. But that was kind of the underlying theme, was sort of a we didn't like the negativity of the mainstream media. It's also kind of an interesting phenomenon.
You need
phenomenon.
To do some work for Yelp, because it's getting – I mean, the comment section, it's just that and Reddit. It's just getting ridiculous.
Yeah. So, you know, we weren't big on the notion of, like, just having 4 out of 5 news stories covering, you know, the murder, rape, and pillage.
Yeah.
We wanted to showcase what was right with the world instead.
That's what Hollywood movies are for, murder, rape, and pillage. That's what their job is. Dude, you are a brilliant dude. I have to tell you, this is amazing. I've never been on a show interviewing someone before where I felt dumber. I have to tell you. And that's a compliment to you. It's unbelievable. It's not dissing anyone else. Lots of smart people have been on the show. That you are, you're on another level. I'm not kidding. So where can people go to follow you and some of the projects you're working on?
For me personally, emersonsparts.com. For the company, dose.com, dose.com.
Thank you, Emerson, for stopping by the studio, Dan. You're a busy dude.
Thanks, man.
Awesome. You can stream this episode and more on the WGN Plus and Rivet Radio apps, or download each episode on iTunes. And remember to stay connected by following us on Twitter at TVT on WGN. Boom, that's a wrap.